owe them, but very few of us know them. They took an oath to protect us at home and abroad, so the rest of us can live safe and free. They are the men and women of our military and first responder communities, and these are their stories. American Warrior Radio is on the air.
Well, hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Ben Bueller Garcia. Welcome to American Warrior Radio. Joseph Galloway, in his book, In We Were Soldiers, wrote, "We who have seen war will never stop seeing it. In the silence of the night, we'll always hear the screams." That quote came to mind often while I was reading Code Red Fallujah, a doctor's memoir at war, the book written by our guest today. His autobiographical account of serving as a warrior healer in one of the most intense and bloody battles of the Iraq War perfectly captures the carnage, the frustration, the fear, the bravery, and the revelations and inspiration that sometimes come from unanticipated corners. He joined the Navy under an agreement that they would pay for medical school if he would serve as an officer for 6 years. He anticipated those 6 years would be with a Marine unit stateside. 9/11 changed all that. He served two combat tours in Iraq, including a deployment right in the middle of the Battle of Fallujah. Welcome to American Warrior Radio, Lieutenant Commander Dr. Donnelly Wilkes.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for having me.
So as a doctor or lieutenant commander, or both?
Now it's just doctor.
Oh, just doctor. Okay.
Well, you know, retired lieutenant commander.
Fair enough. Now, Dr. Wilkes, we get a lot of inquiries from publicists. Honestly, so, you know, a lot of the requests don't quite make the cut. But when I learned your book had been endorsed by two other American Warrior Radio alumni, some guys named Gary Sinise and Joe Montagna, I figured maybe it was worth a look.
I appreciate that. Of course, I am just honored and blessed to have endorsements from those two fine Americans.
Where did you cross paths with those two fellows?
You know, excuse me, you know, the story with Gary Sinise is great. I met him in Iraq on my second tour in about 2008. He was on his USO tour, and he made a stop by our base, Al-Qaim, out on the Syrian border between Iraq and Syria. And I got a chance to meet him, and I said, hey, you know, I'm from California. And he asked where. And at the time, my wife and I were renting a little place in Malibu. And I said, you know, I'm from Malibu. And he said, oh, my gosh, I'm from that area too. And then he said, what did you do wrong to get stuck out here as a Navy physician? So we had a good laugh. And then a number of years later, when I was back in the States, I ran into him at a restaurant, local restaurant. I went up and I just had to say hi. He was just kind enough to spend 20 minutes talking with me, and that's how we met.
Well, he's truly a giving guy. I'm glad you guys connected. Now, a little bit about you, Dr. Wilkes. You really a family tradition of service. Your grandfather was a World War II P-38 pilot, maybe one of the coolest planes ever, and your father was a carpenter-turned-sheriff.
Yes, sir. My grandfather, very proud of him, and he loved to tell stories. I think that's where maybe the roots seeded for my military career. You know, he'd tell stories about how he was shot down by the Germans in North Africa. He crash-landed, survived, and went on to serve in Korea.
Outstanding. Now, what given that sort of tradition, though, what made you want to be a physician?
I think as I proceeded with my education in high school, and I spent the summers working with my father on his construction sites. You know, I loved the work, and he did too. But following my grandfather's footsteps and also my dad's undying desire to serve, he became a sheriff later in his career. It just pushed me to take my education as far as I could, and that led to medical school. And then as I was pursuing a spot, an admission to medical school, a Navy recruiter started talking to me and told me about the benefits of a Navy scholarship, so I applied. I was accepted, and as soon as I had that acceptance, I could go to any medical school that I was granted admission to. So I had you know, a free ride, so to speak, and I chose Tulane University, and the Navy paid for it.
Well, it turns out that ride wasn't quite so free. Now, we get a lot of guests on the show that joined, that enlisted because specifically of 9/11. And as you described it, that was an unprecedented event that would shape many of our lives and in many ways continues to do so. But you were already in, so that wasn't the case for you. You're in your fourth year medical school at Tulane. And tell us about your September 11th day.
like many, I'll never forget the day. I'm in my fourth year doing my early morning rounds at Charity Hospital, which is connected to the medical school. I'm walking across the breezeway back to meet my attending physician for rounds. I see a gaggle of people surrounding a TV on the inside of the hospital doors. I come through and see the smoke rising from the building, a lot of chatter going on, and just kind of stunned look on faces. And I nudged up to them and saw the headlines, the Twin Towers have come down and possible terrorist attack. And I didn't know exactly how, but I knew as I walked the hospital that day that my career in the military, the Navy specifically, was going to be vastly different. And sure enough, it, in short order, it was. You know, there was no Navy brochure for post 9/11. When I joined, it was I'll likely do a tranquil Pacific tour. And as soon as 9/11 happened, those tranquil tours within about a year became combat tours.
Now, you and Katie were pretty much already planning your lives out, and that, like you said, a bit of a monkey wrench there.
We were. And, you know, that's the life of military couples, is mm-hmm. you just don't know what's coming at you. So we had, you know, plans for our wedding, and we had to put it on hold and just adjust course. And there's a couple surprises in the book on how we did that, but we chose a wartime relationship, I love it.
Let's talk about that, because in movies or in sometimes, video games, there are these things called Easter eggs, these funny little secret themes that are placed in the movie, like R2-D2 appeared in Close Encounters of the Third Kind and the Star Wars movie. You put a little Easter egg in Code Red Fallujah to see how many family members actually read the book.
It's true, and it's been so much fun because we're gauging, you know, who's jumping in and reading the book by the text messages we get with, you know, saying, you guys did what? So it's been a lot of fun for us.
Well, I don't want to give too much of the book away, but tell us what you did. I think it's fun.
Sure. It's weeks until I have to deploy, and Katie and I are, you know, reeling from what's happening, but, you know, we understand it's the life we chose. There's an event, and I don't give all these details in the book, but there's an event in Las Vegas for the battalion, the Marine Corps battalion that I'm with. So we're heading there, and basically en route, we kind of look at each other, and I said, hey, babe, I don't want to go off to war, you know, without knowing that we're married, that I have, you know, that solidified for us. And there was a number of reasons why that was important, which we talk about in the book. And I just said, hey, let's go elope in Vegas. And she took a few seconds and looked at me and smiled and said, yeah, babe, let's do it.
But you didn't tell anyone.
We told no one. The only person we told, because we had to, we called up my pastor, Pastor Tim Thompson. He is just the best. He was the pastor for my father's Sheriff's Academy. And we're in the car, and we told him where we were headed and what we were going to do and why. And he said, Donley, Katie, go get married in Vegas and don't tell anybody. Because he knew he would have to, you know, we'd come home and eventually have a big wedding, and he would keep the secret for us.
Well, it's still legal.
That's right, 100%. It's just Nevada.
So real quick, before we take the break, Doctor, so some folks, I know a lot of people still get confused, like how does a Navy doc end up with the Marines? It's actually quite a common thing, but explain the difference between you get a choice of going blue side or green side, and you chose green side, and explain to our listeners what that means.
So that means when I am going into serve my active duty commitment, which was 4 years after residency, so I owed 7 years total, 3 in residency, 4 active duty. You have a choice or a request. It's not granted all the time, but you can go blue side, which essentially means you'll be stationed with usually a ship that has a port. This would have been San Diego or overseas somewhere, and you're attached to that ship and that crew, and they may go out, and you'll go on that ship, and I'll act as the physician for that ship. Or green side, which means you'll go with the Marines, and that could be a number of different positions. For me specifically, it was with an infantry battalion out of Camp Pendleton. So green side Marines, blue side on a ship.
And you chose the Marines. Why?
I did. You know, for me, there was a few different reasons. One, it gave me the best chance of keeping close and stable at Pendleton. In other words, we had bought a condo, Katie and I, so I could know that she would be able to stay in the condo, and that would be our home base. I just loved what the Marines did and how they did it. It was motivating, and I wanted to just kind of jump in and become close with a battalion of 1,000 guys, knowing that where they went, I would follow.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's quite unusual for a Navy doctor to have received the Navy Commendation Medal of Valor. When we come back, you'll find out why. Visit CodeRedFallujah.com. Stick around. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking with Dr. Donnelly Wilkes. Dr. Wilkes joined the Navy, went to medical school, and deployed. Maybe hadn't planned for that, but his latest book, or his book, Code Red Fallujah, is just a very powerful read. I'd encourage you to take a look at it, CodeRedFallujah.com. Dr. Wilkes, a quote from, I alluded to We Were Soldiers before, a quote from Colonel Hal Moore, who was involved in that action. He says, there's no such thing as closure for soldiers who have survived a war. They have an obligation, a sacred duty, to remember those who fell in battle beside them all their days and to bear witness to the insanity that is war. Why did you write this book?
You know, as time passed after I came home, I realized, and it took a little while because the war went on and more battles happened, but I realized what an important event the Battle of Fallujah was. It turned out to be the premier, most violent event of the 10-year Iraq War, and I just happened to be there. My battalion was one of two main attack battalions in the initial assault. The Marines are the tip of the spear when it comes to combat operations. The amount of machinery and men and weaponry that they can mobilize to do what they do is just unbelievable. And I found myself embedded with them. And as they moved into Fallujah, my field aid station moved closer to the front lines in the field, in the open. That was about a three-week campaign. And we received indirect fire, mortars, rockets while treating combat trauma. And it just was a unique event for a Navy physician. I found myself there. I felt that I was blessed to have witnessed it, been through it, and provided care for the men I was with. And for those reasons, I wanted to tell the story.
Now, in the pre-interview, Doctor, we kind of teased about the TV series MASH. But you were in Fallujah. You were within a couple hundred yards of the front lines. I mean, you were close, danger close.
We were close enough, you know, not for small arms fire, which would have been highly odd for them to get that close to us, especially when we had Marines protecting us. But mortars, no problem. They lobbed them in. A couple rockets hit basically right where we were and, knocked us down. You could smell the smoke wafting through. And, you know, we would often hear the battle just ringing out in the background. It was really a surreal place and time to be. And the Cloverleaf, we called it, which was the freeway overpass where we were positioned, was a strategic position for us to be, as well as for combat operations, because tanks and Humvees and men and munitions and resupply, they all went right through the Cloverleaf. So all times of the day or night, it's just constant action going through our position. And that's where they would medevac wounded Marines to. Us right there at the Cloverleaf. We could either treat them, stabilize them, and get them out of there to a higher level of care, or if they had minor injuries, we would treat them on site and get them back in the fight.
Now, you say, I'm their doctor. I go where they go. As a battalion doctor, how many Marines are you responsible for directly?
Myself and my fellow physician, Lieutenant Cormac O'Connor, we were responsible for 1,000 men, roughly 1,000 men. With of those 1,000, there are about 50 to 75 Navy corpsmen. Some of those corpsmen are embedded within the platoons who are actively in the fight in Fallujah, and then some of those corpsmen are positioned with me or Lieutenant O'Connor at the Cloverleaf helping us stabilize and treat. So right on site, you know, in the battlefields, typically a Navy corpsman providing first aid, just stop the bleeding, support the airway, and get them to me or Cormac at the Cloverleaf to take over.
a lot of your book, Doctor, talks about, I mean, you're doing this under, indirect fire, but big things that go boom nonetheless, a lot of mortar rocket attacks. A theme I see is just the mental stress, the frustration. You can't shoot back. I mean...
Go ahead.
Well, no, your very first, I mean, you weren't there but a little while, and then it became a daily occurrence, and just, I can't imagine what that would be like.
You're right, and no one can prepare you for that. You know, you can talk about it, hear about it. We trained in the field before we went out. I went to combat casualty care course. I went on night raids in attack mode out on Camp Pendleton with the Marines, you know, emulating what it might be like to be in the field. But nothing can prepare you for when those, you know, bullets start firing in the background, mortars are dropping, the concussive force, the blast forces. And it may not wound you directly, let's say a mortar or a rocket blast, but the mental torment is just intense. And you live at a 10 out of 10 intensity level for every day that you're there. And you can't just turn that off when you come home. And so you learn, you're in survival mode, you know, while you're there to do your job. And it is it's just a day-by-day evolution of learning how to live and survive in this environment and then do what you're there to do. For me, it was to be a healer, yet I'm in a combat zone, and the juxtaposition of that was sometimes very challenging emotionally and spiritually.
Now, you say that field medicine is very different from hospital medicine. I figure a lot of us could probably figure that out on our own, but you talked about your job in the field that really was to stabilize those patients and get them to the next level of care. You discussed the a lot of things have changed in medicine, in combat medicine. A lot of things haven't. And you described there's a three main types of killing wounds. And you alluded to what you were doing there to address that. What are those three main wounds? What types?
Yes, so the main causes of battlefield trauma, death, or just the most severe injuries are going to be blast wounds that may cause a pneumothorax, which is air trapped around the lungs, causes a collapsed lung, and then bullet, mortar, or other blast wounds that cause major hemorrhage and bleeding out, and head wounds. And although you're right, a lot of advancements have occurred in military medicine, it's usually at the higher echelons of care. And by that, I mean I was echelon one, field medicine, stabilize the bleeding, support the airway, support the circulation. Not a lot has changed over the years in our ability at that first level. There's a few advancements. We have some things like quick clot that can stop bleeding fast. We've got some advanced airway kits that I use, for example, to put in a surgical airway in the field, a very difficult procedure. At that second echelon, where they can get them to a surgical company, that's where major advancements have been made. There's surgeons that can essentially perform life-saving surgeries almost to the extent that you can in the States right there in the field at level two care.
Now, Dr. Wilkes, Ben gets a dumb question every show, and you touched on it because that's one thing. How does quick clot work? I mean, we've got police officers carrying them now, and they're very important.
Yes. Essentially, without going into all the chemistry of it, it's a powder, at least the form that we had. It's meant for large or open wounds with uncontrolled bleeding, and as soon as you dump that quick clot into that site of massive bleeding, it creates a chemical reaction that causes rapid or quick clotting of the blood to hopefully stop the hemorrhage.
And then you place a bandage over that?
That's right, and then after that, you know, you're going to do other things that you can do, whether it's pressure or tourniquets and dressings to help stop the bleeding.
When we come back, Doctor, I want to talk about your first combat casualty. And for combat doctors in the field, that's not an unusual occurrence, but yours might have been a little bit in that it was memorialized via a photograph that went worldwide. I want to talk about that when we come back. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking with Dr. Donnelly Wilkes. His book is Code Red Fallujah. You can find out more. Visit CodeRedFallujah.com. Fallujah has two L's. Stick around. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking with Dr. Donnelly Wilkes. Dr. Wilkes was a Navy doctor embedded with the Marines during one of the most violent combat actions of the Iraq War there in Fallujah. Dr. Wilkes, I alluded to the fact that you're pretty early on when you were there at that forward operating base, you had your first combat casualty. And you talk about going back to your training and you really say, look, in combat medicine, you do the best you can, but you can't look back. You can't dwell on it because you got to move on to help the next person. But that first loss weighed pretty heavy.
It did. It did. That was an intense moment. And you're right. Field medicine is vastly different from when you're in a controlled environment in a hospital or an emergency room setting. You just don't have the extent of tools and diagnostic capabilities. So you really have to rely on your instinct, on your clinical skills that you know you have, and learn to also forgive yourself, not look back, have regrets, or really even question yourself because you know you've got the tools you need, and you're right. You just have to move on when you know it's time to move on.
The added pressure of not only trying to save a life in a very difficult environment, sometimes under fire, but then one thing that I hadn't thought about before is, you know, very often these Marines are bringing their comrades into you in a Humvee, maybe not even in an ambulance, and they're standing there. They're waiting. They're looking over your shoulder, hoping that you'll save their comrade. And just that little extra added pressure has got to be pretty tough.
It is. And, you know, one of the most intense events that you had alluded to previously was Lieutenant Jackson. He was one of the first Marines that I had to treat who ended up dying of his wounds. And I'll never forget, you know, he arrives with a almost mortal head wound, but he's still alive. And I'm just asking, really, the good Lord, why is this man still alive? And what should we even do about it, if anything? Because I knew his semblance of life would be very, very slim. And it took mere seconds. You know, his Marines are behind us, and the battle's raging in the background still. And I just knew we needed to show them, his Marines, that we'll do everything we can every time, even if we know maybe it's a futile attempt. And that's why we commenced with all-out efforts, of course, for Lieutenant Jackson.
There's another scene where you basically said, hey, everybody who's not a corpsman, get the heck out of the way so we can do our job. Seconds matter. Doctor, one of the things that's always fascinated me, we've had other warrior healers on the show. One show we did with Dr. Richard Carmona, who was the former Surgeon General. He began as a combat medic with the Green Berets. And Dr. Josh Apple, who was the pararescueman on the famous Lone Survivor mission. And the juxtaposition between being a warrior and a healer. While you're doing all this, you're carrying a sidearm, and you're prepared to use it if you need to. And one of the greatest stories I can think of was Dr. Carmona was he was a physician. He was also the doctor for the local college team. He was on the SWAT team. He's driving to a football game. There's a fellow in the intersection out there shooting at people. So Dr. Carmona exits his vehicle, draws his service weapon, shoots the bad guy, holsters his weapon, and then immediately runs up and starts trying to save his life from the bullet that he put in him. How do you reconcile that as a healer and a warrior, or do you don't? Those are your jobs. You do them.
Yeah, I love that story, and the best example I can give of that, and to preface that, you're right. You're in this environment where all your training up until you join an infantry battalion or you go out into active duty in a combat zone, as a physician, it's all based around healing. Do no harm. Do everything you can for the patient every time. And, of course, that translates to your Marines. And then you're put into this combat environment. And I do carry a weapon, and I will use it if I have to. And we're trained to use our weapons. Yet I know something has gone seriously wrong if I ever had to. And so to your question or your point, as a healer, I know that first and foremost, I'm there to care for the Marines. But there is one event, and this kind of translates into your story about Dr. Carmona, where sometimes insurgents are captured in the battle, and then they're brought through our position at the Cloverleaf. And in this one instance, they bring through a few captured insurgents. They're bound. They're wounded. They have gunshot wounds. And they put them on my stretcher, and I have to inspect them to make sure that they're stable for transport. And if they're not, if they had wounds that needed to be attended to stabilize them, because we're the United States, that's what we do. And that was one of my jobs, was to have to also treat these insurgents who were just out there trying to kill my men. So it was a very tough position mentally to handle. And in the end, I just told myself, my job is Marines first, and that was always the case. If there was ever a case where I needed to prioritize, of course, Marines are first. But beyond that, I am a healer, and it's not up to me to decide what and pick who that I tend to. And if that had to be a wounded insurgent, because that's our calling and that's the level of commitment the United States subscribes to, then so be it. And it was out of my hands, so I just did my job that I was there to do.
So that really, and you're very candid in your book, Doctor, about how that really tested not only your oath, but also to some extent your faith. Maybe?
Yes, it did. And I do talk about my faith and the evolution of that throughout the book, and a lot of things tested my faith. And I also wanted my readers to know that's okay. God understands that. We're human. We're perfect. We're supposed to go through these roller coasters and ups and downs, and I went through mine. And in the chapter titled The Spiritual Reckoning, I talk about the most intense battle, internal battle I had with my faith and understanding why God brought me to this place, why I was put in the positions that I was. And that evolution came full circle, and I describe that in The Spiritual Reckoning and how it helped me persevere beyond that day. And really to this point in my current life, how those experiences, those emotional tug of war, so to speak, helped me not only get through the deployment and the Battle of Fallujah, but helped me today.
Doctor, we've had Jeff Strucker on the show. He wrote a book called Bulletproof Faith. I don't know if you know his story. He was an Army Ranger. He was involved in the first Battle of Mogadishu, or the Battle of Mogadishu, the famous for Black Hawk Down. He was driving the Humvee with the very first casualty, Dominic Pillow. And he says, they go back to the base, they're washing the blood out of the Humvee, and they're getting shot up all night long. And he was totally convinced he was going to die. But his fellow Rangers approached him and said, why are you so calm about this? And it was because of his faith. You had some interesting experiences as well there with Marines coming up to you and asking you questions that aren't medical questions, but are spiritual questions. And I found that very, very powerful. I mean, does God drop hints?
Absolutely. If you ask me, 1,000%, he dropped them to me. And they're not always 100% clear. That's the journey. But you're right. I had some intense conversations with Marines who became, of course, my close friends and brothers while you're there. And they were coming to me with some serious questions about God and what it's all about. And specifically one Marine who had 3 close brushes with death. One night he finds me when we're walking back from the chow hall late at night, and he says, "Sir, I just got to ask you some questions here. I've almost, died 3 times here, but here I am. And I feel like, I'm trying to do better. I'm trying to make amends, but I feel like God's punishing me." And I could tell how much he was struggling with where he was at. And I said, "Corporal, I got to tell you, I can't explain why you're going through what you are, why perhaps, God's putting you to the test or just life is putting you to the test. But if you ask me, God's sending you a message right now that he still wants you here. It's a miracle that you've survived these 3 brushes with death. That's what I see that he's telling you." And he went forward and finished the deployment in fine fashion. And as far as I know, he's doing well today.
Outstanding. Now, They say every Marine is an infantryman. I guess because you're a Navy, technically, they'd forgive you for just carrying a pistol. But maybe they won't forgive you for this next question, but I have to ask. As a physician, what is the absolute worst Marine chow for the human body?
The worst Marine chow. Well, it's got to be what we call tray rats. And these were just giant trays.
Now, just to clarify, you're referring to rats as rations, not whisker rats. Okay.
That's right.
Well, it was Fallujah, you know, you never know.
That's right, yeah, and there's so many acronyms when you're in the military. So that's right, tray rations. And they're just massive pre-prepared vats of food that are heated up and, you know, served either in a chow hall or out in the food, and they're dense and thick with calories and salt and you name it. And, you know, it does the job, but you don't want to have to do it more than you have to.
Good advice. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we come back. We're going to get some more advice from the doctor, the lieutenant commander doctor. It's interesting when you were standing there getting ready to deploy and load the bus as you described, you see some of the other Marines are coming back and you almost envied them because they'd done their time. And your welcome home was something very similar. Ladies and gentlemen, Ben Buehler-Garcia joined by Dr. Donnelly Wilkes, CodeRedFallujah.com. Check it out. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Buehler-Garcia, having a very powerful discussion with Dr. Donnelly Wilkes. Dr. Wilkes was in the Navy, was deployed with the Marines twice, actually, and his first deployment, he ended up in the mess that came to be known as the Battle of Fallujah. Dr. Wilkes, I found it interesting. You actually began writing your book on your second deployment, and it was therapy for you.
It was. You know, when that second deployment came up, it was a little unexpected, and, of course, emotions were stirred. Katie and I had to reconcile again with, you know, another 10 months apart. And part of getting through a deployment, despite the action and, you know, a lot of big events, is a lot of downtime and just managing the time of deployment. You know, time can just be such a killer. So I started writing the book. And as I, you know, kind of sat out in the remote outskirts of Iraq, out in Al-Qaim, I just found myself hearing and seeing those events from Fallujah. And I started putting them on paper, and that was how Code Red Fallujah was born.
To me, one of the more touching, well, several moments in the book, you talk about as you're getting ready to deploy the first time and just the sadness of being separated from your family. And I don't recall if some of the other Marines were coming back or it had been set up to welcome home. Those Marines are coming back from deployment, and you almost envied them. You wanted it to be over already, but you also knew you had to do your duty. Now, it probably wasn't so bad. I think about the Marines on a cargo ship for months at a time deploying to the Pacific in the Second World War. You flew first class. That ain't bad.
No, not bad at all. We did. I couldn't believe it because, you know, the Marines pride themselves on doing more with less. So to walk out on the tarmac on the runway and climb up on this double-decker, I think it was an American Airlines plane, up into first class was just unbelievable. And I relished every moment of that. But you're right, I was, you know, you've seen it in war movies. Some men and women are coming home and others are on their way out. And you're just passing by them, literally, at the airport or, you know, in our case, we also had to convoy. And it's hard not to feel just a longing to be on the other side of it and on the way home.
You know, Doc, I'm busting your chops about being a Navy guy with the Marines. When you finally get home, you're marching in formation, which you're supposed to do, but the Navy guy just broke formation and ran to his family. Come on.
I did. We're marching in at Camp Pendleton, just one of the best days of my life. The Marines in formation. We're rounding a corner and I can hear the fanfare and we start to see, you know, family members and heads bobbing up and down. And there's my dad. And it was almost instinct. I lost my training for a second, and I just broke out of formation and ran and hugged my dad.
Well, they forgave you. I mean, they kept you, right?
So they did.
You're okay. sir, there's, we're, you know, great guests. We always run short on time, but I want to touch on something towards the end of the book. You make some very key points, and I want you to expound on them because these apply to everybody, military, first responder, or just civilian schlubs like me. You say, don't wait for life to come to you. With the right training, you can do great things. Among these three key elements: get your heart and your mind balanced, get your body fit, grab a fistful of courage, and go after it. There is no finish line. God does not have a scoreboard for our lives. Can you just expound on those three key principles for our listeners, sir?
Yeah, I'd love to, and I'll try to be quick on each one. As I wrote the book, and I was, you know, trying to think of how I can describe the life lessons learned and apply them to how I applied them to my life, and how I could translate that to my readers. You know, this is a roughly 10-year period we're talking about, from medical school and my military career and things like that, and some key elements became clear to me as I went on in life that really spoke to me, and those are the three you just read. The first is get your heart and mind balanced. What does that mean? It's different for everybody, and the time it takes to do this is different for everybody. But I've said before, and it's not cliche, you are the most important person you will ever meet. Don't be late to that meeting. And what I mean by that is the love of yourself, finding that love for yourself, is a journey. It's an evolution. And we all should strive for that, because that's what allows us to be not only our best selves, but then be a light to the world. When you can and in my mind, this doesn't happen without God. When you can love yourself enough to forgive yourself for your mistakes, celebrate your triumphs, then you're ready to give that to someone else, to give love to someone else, to forgive someone else, and to then be a champion in whatever life's endeavor that you choose. So that's what I mean by getting your heart and mind balanced. And of course, there's a lot of key things that go into how we do that. The second component that I think is involved is get your body fit. I described in the book, humans are the most technologically, physiologically advanced living organism in the history of the universe that we know of. And you've got to treat that vessel well. You have to do that to expect things to go right. If you don't expect things to go well. And so by that, I'm talking about fitness, some cardio fitness, strength training, stretching. I'm talking about nutrition. The best nutrients in the world come right from Mother Earth. And I give a few examples on what I mean by that. You know, eat organic if you can. Try not to eat too much processed food. Get plenty of hydration. So get your body fit. And then finally, when you've done the best preparation you can, when your heart and mind is balanced, when you feel like your body's fit, you're ready to go. And the next step is simply grab that fistful of courage and go after it. And that means that you've done your best to prepare. You know there's still risks. You know that it may not go well, and you may fall and fail, and you'll just have to get yourself up and dust yourself off again and move forward. And when you can say that and do that, knowing that it's all in the pursuit of hopefully success and love and a happy life, then you're ready. And don't look back. Grab that fistful of courage and go for it.
Sir, I've never seen combat. I've never been in the military, but I have been involved in business for a long time. That when you talk about taking the reins and getting a fistful of courage and going out, and you started your own practice, how's that going?
You know, I credit the Navy for setting me up for success. That's the way it is, I think, in any branch of the military. If you're motivated and you're ready to take it on, you are given a lot of responsibility. And they just continue to escalate that. And so you learn a lot of good skills, leadership skills, even business skills, and in my case, medical skills. So I was well prepared when I was finished with my time in the Navy, and I was excited and fired up to get out of the Navy and use all that I had learned to open my own practice. And it's going well. It's not without its challenges, that's for sure, but I love it, and I hope to do it for the rest of my life.
Dr. Wilkes, we've got 2 minutes left. One of the phrases that jumped out at me, you're and your comrades are at the funeral for the Marines that didn't make it home. And I think someone said, you know, words alone can never yield the sum of what these men represent. Very, very powerful phrase. Is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners today about your comrades, whether they're Marines or airmen or coasties or sailors or, I mean, you know, whom I'm forgetting, but just the men and women that are standing up and agreeing to stand the watch so the rest of us can be safe here at home.
Yes, I'd like to tell your listeners that they are the fabric of the red, white, and blue, and I truly mean that. And like anyone, we're not perfect, but we've chosen a path that is not an easy one, but is full of adventure, triumph and failures. And in the end, you know, when you go on a deployment, you truly are a band of brothers or sisters. In my case, I was in an all-male battalion. And you find that it doesn't matter where this person came from, what they may have done in their past, that guy sitting next to you is on the same journey that you are, and the only way to get to the end of the line and earn that right to come home is by doing it together. And so you just develop a special bond with these men. And for me personally, some of my best and closest friends were some of the Marine Corps officers who welcomed me into their tribe, so to speak. And just to name a few, Jamie Edge, Mike Butler, Phil Treglia, and Captain Jamie McCall, who is the battalion lawyer. And I love them. And I am lucky and blessed to have met them and know them as fellow officers.
You know, I'm glad you brought that up because that's one thing I didn't get to, and we won't have time for it, but it's not very often a Navy combat surgeon gets to participate in a sting operation. Folks will have to buy the book and read about that. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Code Red Fallujah. You can find out more at CodeRedFallujah.com. Dr. Wiltz, thanks for spending some time with our listeners today.
Thank you, Ben. I appreciate what you do.
Ladies and gentlemen, over 250 other interviews can be found at AmericanWarriorRadio.com, podcast on all your favorite platforms, Apple, Google, Stitcher, Pandora, Spotify. You can find us anywhere. Please have a listen, and please, please share these important messages. Until next time, all policies and procedures are to remain in place. Take care.
You've been listening to American Warrior Radio. You can hear over 150 episodes of this program at AmericanWarriorRadio.com.